AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. The East Coast is about to get it from a winter storm that's left ice and snow from Texas through the Midwest. National Weather Service meteorologist Brian Hurley.
Widespread area of wintry weather. A lot of sleet, snow, and freezing rain. More so the transitioning to sleet and freezing rain across the mid-Atlantic and into the Northeast.
Hurley and others at the Weather Service have posted ice storm warnings this morning along the Ohio Valley. There's a winter storm warning along the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina, Virginia, and West Virginia. Forecast calling for snow, sleet, and freezing rain through tomorrow morning. The White House says diplomacy is still the best solution with Iran on its nuclear program. AP Radio Shirley Smith with more.
President Obama says he thinks the chances for success are 50-50 or less, but still worth the effort.
Even as I don't take any options off the table, what we do have to test is the possibility that we can resolve this issue diplomatically.
Secretary of State John Kerry addressed Israeli concerns.
The United States is always particularly prepared to be the first and fastest to Israel's side in any time of crisis.
Both men say if there's a chance at a solution, then it's worth the effort. Shirley Smith, Washington.
In South Africa today, a day of prayer for Nelson Mandela.
The praise for now is for the country, is for his family, is for his soul, but these prayers don't necessarily end the day he is laid to rest.
A national memorial service for the country's first black president will be held on Tuesday. Police in Manchester, Connecticut say a man killed three women, then himself last night when he was confronted by officers. The officers were responding to a 911 call when the armed man was leaving an apartment building carrying a young child. When he saw the officers, he put down the child and shot himself. This is AP Radio News. The United Nations says Afghan authorities have been slow in enforcing a law protecting women against forced marriage, domestic violence, and rape. UN mission to Afghanistan says authorities have had more reports of violence against women, but prosecutions and convictions are low. Singer Susan Boyle says she's been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome.
Boyle, who sold millions of records, has told Britain's Observer newspaper that she saw a specialist a year ago, and it's now a relief to have the right label for her condition. She says she'd been misdiagnosed after complications at birth and had always been labelled as brain damaged. Asperger's affects social interaction and communication skills and sometimes hinders the ability to assess what's appropriate behaviour. The church volunteer became a global sensation in 2009 when she sang I Dreamed a Dream on a talent show. Charles de Ledesma, London.
I'm Tim McGuire, AP Radio News.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce and sponsored by Bernhardt Wealth Management, helping make your life decisions around finance easy. And this is your host, Peter Schwartz. Today's show is a great one. We have on our show today Norma Shahara, who's a partner with Luce Gorman, Sally Seiler, the CEO of Neurology Center, Andy Stern and his father, Sam Stern, who Andy's the president of Andy Stern's Office Furniture, and Rob Cartel, who's the chairman and CEO of Intellix. First up is Norma Shahara, who is a partner with Luce Gorman. What is Luce Gorman?
Hey, Peter. Thanks for having me today. Luce Gorman is a boutique law firm in Washington, D.C. It's one of the nation's leading banking law firms, with particular emphasis on mergers and acquisitions and capital raising for small community banks and credit unions.
When you say a boutique law firm, what does that mean?
Well, we're 21 lawyers, and 18 of the 21 are partners. So we're rather top-heavy when you think about a typical law firm. There's a lot of leverage. But that's not the case with a boutique, because clients want to be able to get experienced lawyers at the push of a button and right. have them answer their phone calls.
And you serve a very specific clientele, is that correct?
That's right. Luce Gorman focuses on community banks. We work with Main Street, not Wall Street. My particular expertise is in executive compensation and employee benefits, so we're dealing with pension plans, 401k plans, executive retirement plans, employment contracts, all in the context of local community banks. The local community banks are the pillars of their community, much like in the holiday movie It's a Wonderful Life, all of our clients think they're Jimmy Stewart.
All right. When was the law firm founded?
About 20 years ago.
And when did you join?
I joined the firm 8 years ago.
Why did you want to be a part of this firm?
It was a fantastic opportunity. They are working with a group of people who are leaders in their small town communities. And I grew up in a suburb of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, small town feel. And I love the idea of working with Main Street instead of Wall Street.
And why banking? Do you have an interest in finance?
Not particularly, but this firm had an opening for a position in executive compensation and benefits at a time when there had been a major change in the law and they needed partner level expertise. They called me up one day and said, "Well, we understand what you do is like playing three-dimensional chess. You already do tax and securities and labor. Would you mind adding a fourth layer so you can add banking regulation on top of that?" And I thought, ooh, an even more complicated puzzle. Yes, sign me up.
So when did solving puzzles first become important to you or interesting to you?
Well, I always had a knack for finding my way through a maze.
Always had a knack for finding a way through a maze. How early?
Well, I recall being a child and being able to see connections and relationships that other people weren't aware of.
How young were you when you could do that?
Well, when I was 12, I started a paper route that developed into an empire. And the way I saw making those connections that other people didn't was the current paper girl had no interest in doing her job. And I said, "Well, let me come around with you and see what you're doing." And I instantly noticed what she was doing wrong. And I thought, if I could improve and deliver a clean, dry newspaper on every doorstep, I would get better tips. I started delivering the Sunday coupons on Saturday. And that really impressed the customer base. And I got even better tips. Then I hired my brothers to work the routes on either side of mine. And the more you viewed it as a relationship and a customer base and servicing their needs and enchanting them with something slightly different, as simple as a newspaper, they were loyal customers and my subscriptions went
and,
up.
And you were doing all this at around 12?
Yes.
What'd you do with the money you made in your first year?
Well, my first year, my brothers and I pooled our money and bought my mother a microwave for Christmas and bought my father a snowblower.
What was that experience like for you?
It was fantastic.
To do something like that for your mom and dad?
It was fantastic. Of course, delivering the newspaper, we saw the advertisements, and we knew exactly how much those things cost. And our parents, we were sure to be surprised, and the reason we did it was to show them that we could.
Yeah. And what do you remember them saying?
That's not suitable for radio.
Oh, but they were impressed, I'll bet.
They were very surprised and
something
impressed.
Something like holy
yes.
mackerel?
Yes, along those
colorful.
Lines, yes. Yes, I grew up in blue-collar Pittsburgh,
okay.
So yes.
And then, so in year two, what'd you do with the money?
Well, we did our own things, and among other things, you know, it was a king's ransom at that age to have the kind of money that we did. But we also saved for college because right. our parents had made it very clear, there were five of us in the family, that if we wanted to go to college, we were going to have to figure it out for ourselves. They weren't going to take food off the table from the other children to pay for books and tuition. And so the money we would save for college education and other things.
And why law?
Well, I decided that I was going to work. I knew my future was going to involve working at something. And I decided, well, who makes a lot of money? Doctors and lawyers. And since I faint at the sight of blood, then law it was going to be. Lawyers also seem to be very respected in the community. They seem to have nice houses and nice things, and people listen to what they said. And I love it when people listen to what I say.
So I asked you to describe yourself with an adjective, and you came up with the word ungovernable.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Well, I often go in a different direction, march to my own drummer, and often gets me in trouble. But for the most part, I found that also wins you relationships and loyalty and respect from people by being able to view things creatively.
What do you like most about practicing the law?
I like being in charge. Someday someone's going to find out that they're paying me for my opinion. My daughter thinks that's really entertaining, that people pay her mother to tell them what what I think about things.
So is it about keeping your clients out of trouble or helping them see into the future? What do you do best?
It is helping them avoid problems. Through 20 years of experience as a lawyer, I've like to say I've seen it all, but then a client calls and says, they've just done something and it's something new. But it's an opportunity to be a tour guide through a regulatory jungle.
Right. What'd you learn from your father growing up?
Well, my father was a financial printer growing up, and he was covered in ink, just like I was covered in ink from delivering the newspapers. I learned how important getting things right are and pleasing the clients. If you're printing a prospectus, for example, and there's a mistake on the middle of it in page 100 of 150 pages, you're staying overtime and costing the client money, and your boss is going to be mad. So you really have to get the little things right.
Right. And how about your mom?
My mom always said, tell it like it is, that everybody is the same. There are people who are high-class people with high-wealth people with low-class behavior, and there are low-wealth people with high-class behavior. But everybody is the same.
Where's the future of law with respect to your business?
Well, unfortunately, the government keeps pushing out more and more regulations on the banking industry, and community banks' scalability is a problem. Everybody has to comply with these rules, whether you are Wall Street or whether you're Main Street. And so we are in a consolidating industry. It's a shame to see Jimmy Stewart's, It's a Wonderful Life, Building and Loan being merged out of existence with the evil Mr. Potter.
What do you think we'll lose if we lose community banks?
The personal touch. And so much is done online, and I do banking online myself. I think it's wonderful and convenient. But the relationships that community banks have with their communities are very important.
How has the business of law changed since you've been practicing?
Well, it really is a business. You have to have relationships, but of course you need to make sure that people are, paying their bills, mm-hmm. and being respectful of your time and what we do as professionals.
What's the toughest thing you've ever accomplished, Norma?
Personally, professionally?
Either one. First impulse, best impulse.
Well, my daughter is bilingual. She speaks Arabic and English. My husband was from Egypt. And when the night before my wedding, my mother said, you're ruining your life marrying someone who is not Irish Catholic and from Pittsburgh, this Arab Muslim from the other side of the world, and what kind of life are you going to have? So I think one of the hardest things I did was standing up to my parents, and I have a beautiful 28-year-old daughter and two lovely grandsons.
How about professionally?
Professionally, I've always spoken what's on my mind, even when it's unpopular, and I've almost gotten fired many times because of it, but often I end up winning a new client, and oftentimes they're very big-ticket clients.
Why is law a good place to begin a career? For a young person listening in, why should somebody think about law as a career?
It teaches you how to think critically, and that's so important no matter if you're going into a business, if you're going into finance, if you're going into teaching, if you're going into being a stay-at-home parent, being able to think critically and having a decision tree and looking at a dispassionate analysis of the choices in front of you.
And how about your proudest moment up till now?
I think it was my daughter getting her master's degree. A bachelor's degree was always going to be a must for her, but she teaches first grade, and she wanted to get a master's in education, and I did not push her, but she did it herself, she paid for it herself, and I'm very proud of that.
Great. What's the website address for the law firm?
It is looselaw.com, looselaw.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Norma Sherrara, who is a partner with Luce Gorman. Don't forget to visit our website, Executive Leaders Radio, for more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spot. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your business spotlight. Joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of Sam Foster, who's the CEO of Foster Soft, Inc. What is Foster Soft, Inc., Sam?
Foster's Office, a professional services and IT firm. We are based in Bethesda, Maryland. We typically provide services to the federal government, as well as some commercial contracts and international work as well.
Well, give us an example of what you might do for a federal government customer.
Absolutely. There may be an effort where we're modernizing. There may be an effort where we're bridging the gap between legacy technology and emerging technology, or building a data warehouse for one of the regulators.
How long have you had the business?
The business was founded in 1999, so we've been around for 14 years.
So it sounds like a fun place to work. Why should somebody join your company?
Well, we have a culture at FosterSoft that lends itself to a high degree of professionalism, integrity, commitment. We provide value to our customers, and they keep inviting us back to play.
What do you like most about running the company?
What I like about it, that's a very good question. First of all, I enjoy the workforce. We invest in our employees. The customer realizes that we make that investment. We also give back to our community. We are very good at that. We have an endowment account where we give back to grants to universities and colleges. And we have programs like internship programs where we bring kids in from colleges and universities around the country.
And how can someone reach you?
You can reach us at www.fostersoft.com.
One more time.
www.fostersoft.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Sam Foster, who's the CEO of fostersoft.com. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and that was your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce and sponsored by Bernhardt Wealth Management, helping to make work optional for you. This is Peter Schwartz, your host, and joining us for this segment is a young lady by the name of Sally Seiler, who is the CEO of a company called Neurology Center. What is Neurology Center, Sally?
The Neurology Center is a single specialty medical practice. We're located in Maryland, Montgomery County, and the District of Columbia. We provide neurological services for adults.
When you say neurological services, to the layman, what does that mean?
Well, neurology is the study of the brain and the spinal cord, the nervous system. So anyone that has an issue from headaches, migraines, to MS, to stroke, brain tumors, numbness, those are all ALS, Parkinson's disease, dizziness, those are...
So your organization specializes in the treatment of those kinds
correct.
Of things,
we
huh?
We do the examination consultations, and we do testing right. services. We have a sleep lab.
Ah.
Sleep disorders is a huge neurological problem, and it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Why do you suppose that is?
Well, the population is aging. We're getting heavier. And it's been a fairly undiagnosed problem, and as sort of the baby boomers worry about their cognitive decline, some of it relates to sleep.
Yeah, sleep's pretty important, I hear.
Sleep's very important.
When was the organization founded?
It was founded in 1969.
Uh-huh. And how big or small today?
Well, it went through... A significant change in 1995. It was quite a large organization, but the state of Maryland, and we were, let me just back up for a minute, we were the largest owner of MRI facilities in the area. We had operations at that point in Virginia as well. In 1994, I believe, or 95, the state of Maryland became the only state in the union to outlaw a physician owning an MRI facility or an imaging facility to which it might refer a patient. So we had to get rid of all of our imaging facilities, and at that point the organization went from 300 employees to about 60 employees. And
that had to be traumatic.
Well, it was. I wasn't a part of the organization then. I was brought in at that point thinking that we might think about bankruptcy or reorganizing the company or whatever.
So you're a for-hire CEO.
Well, I had my own little consulting business. I was doing financial workouts, and a lawyer friend of mine said, would you help these guys out? And that's when I told him, I don't know anything about medicine. And he said, well, that's good because they don't know anything about business. It'll work out just fine.
So what surprised you most when you got involved?
Well, I mean, the first thing I did was I said, well, can you show me your budget? And I got this deadpan stare, budget. And I said, okay, well, then why don't you show me some of your contracts, like your leases? Do you have a fee schedule? Big duh on the other end. And so I figured I was in for
a long time.
Well, I mean, these guys were just missing it from A to Z. So
how did you go about turning it around?
Well, first of all, I wanted to study their revenue stream. How do you make money? And I needed to look at where your costs are. And in fact, literally, the docs weren't taking home paychecks, and they were hemorrhaging real estate. And I looked around, and one of the things I recognized was they had the whole back of the house operation, that is billing and collecting and human resources and all that kind of stuff, in really, really, really expensive real estate. This was in 1995, and they were paying over $40 a foot.
Wow.
And I said, look, here's the first thing. I'm going to move this entire operation to $15 a foot, free parking, and we're going to be near a metro. And they said, oh, well, you have to have a doctor in the office. I said, why? What does a doctor need to be here
for?
So
you just disrupted all the assumptions.
I did.
And
I
said, what was it like to have to do that?
Well, luckily,
particularly since you weren't a doctor. So how were you going about getting credible?
I think that I just presented. I'm a numbers runner. I do spreadsheets. I just presented the numbers to him. I said, look, we can save $300,000 or $400,000 a year by doing this. We can save, you know.
Yeah, but you didn't have a lot of time to turn this around, I bet. So how did you do it?
I dissected the organization, and well, one of the first things I did, I hadn't been there more than a month or so, and someone came to me and wanted to order a bunch of office supplies, and I said, I'm so sick and tired of you guys thinking this place is just handing out money. I said, okay, Friday, I want you all to wear your grubbies, and we're going to clean out every single closet in this operation, and we're going to ask the satellite offices to do the same thing.
Including the doctors.
No, the doctors, they kept seeing patients because that's how we make money. But I mean, the staff do that. We had enough office supplies for at least 6, if not 8 months that we didn't have to order a single pen. We didn't have to buy an adding machine. We didn't have to buy adding machine tape. Back then, everything was paper. We didn't have to buy envelopes. We didn't have to buy any. I mean, it was just that kind of stupidity that everyone was hauling and hoarding their own little office supplies.
So have you always wanted to do this, turn companies around, crunch the numbers?
Actually, what I really loved doing was doing deals. I had been in public accounting, and I didn't particularly like auditing. I was in the tax department. And my biggest client was a tax syndicator. We syndicated real estate. I worked on the commercial side with office buildings, and I loved doing deals. We went out to the market and syndicated them. We used, you know, Wall Street firms to do that. I thought that was great fun. And then in 1986, the tax law changed that, took that deal away. So then I ended up joining a warehouser company called Winchester Homes, which is a big local home builder, and they were just starting up a land development division, but they knew how to build a house, and that was it. So I said, well, I can help you. We can do land deals. Because I love to do deals. We can do the deals. I can get the financing for you and so on.
So what did you do, major in accounting in college?
No, I was a high school history teacher. I majored in history.
So how does that happen? You majored in history, and then you became an accountant. Where's the linkage?
Well, the linkage is that I had a early unsuccessful marriage, but I did my husband's books at the same time I was teaching school. And I hated teaching school because I felt like a truant officer, but I loved doing his books and working, you know, with the business. And so when we were separating, I found a graduate program here in Georgetown, and I went and interviewed for it. And the guy that interviewed me was a partner in a major Big Eight firm, and he asked me that very question: what's the linkage between history and accounting? And I looked at him, and I just popped right out of my mouth. I said, it's the same thing. You use primary. When I was teaching history, I was using primary documents, primary source documents, and trying to reconstruct or create a story based on those documents and things. And my understanding is that that is what accounting does. It takes primary documents, whether they be contracts or cash received or whatever, and creates a story at year end or end of the quarter. Or
and you're good at that, drawing together the primary documents to create a story.
Right.
And you love doing that. I mean, you just brighten up when you say it. So what is it that's so fascinating about that?
Well, and I like creating things. Most recently, I set up a sleep lab, and I ran all of the – I persuaded the docs to – we need to invest in this. We can make good money at it. It's a service we've heretofore not offered our patients. We've referred them out, and they were not satisfied with the services they were getting outside of our practice. And I said, we have a business. We want to do a business model that's a little different than everybody else. We want to make it a 5-star experience based on my hotel experience. And I said, I understand rates and occupancies and all that kind of stuff. So it's a business that we should go in.
Where are you from, Sally?
I'm from Michigan.
And what was life growing up in Michigan like?
I thought it was ideal. I mean, I grew up fairly privileged. I'm actually a fifth-generation graduate from the University of Michigan. So my grandparents on my father's side were also – that was on my mother's side. On my father's side, they were also 3 or 4 generations.
What do you remember most about your childhood that kind of shaped who you are today?
Athletic events. We were always very athletic. I learned to swim at an early age. I was an avid tennis player. Both my parents were. I loved baseball and doing all kinds of running and ice skating, and my dad was a jock, and he...
How do you think your dad influenced you?
Oh, wow. He was a big influence. He was very principled. I'll tell you a story. In the 7th grade, he said, okay, time for you to be responsible for money, and he made me negotiate my allowance as well as the tasks that I needed to do to do that allowance. And, you know, he made me account for everything that I needed to spend money on, like taking the bus. I had to take a city bus and lunch and spending money and blah, 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 blah.
That continued into college, I understand.
It continued into college where he said, okay, this is now going for college. I want to pay for your entire college education, but I need you to tell me what it's going to cost. So you need to go look and see what the tuition is and the room and board and what your books are going to cost and all that kind of stuff. So the very first semester, I go ahead and pay all my room and board and tuition and all that kind of stuff. But then there was a Saks Fifth Avenue shop on campus, and I had a little bit of a shoe fetish, and I blew the money. So I knew he'd be furious and mostly disappointed. That was the worst thing. I didn't want to disappoint him. And so I went and got a job at the local quad at the dish machine and doing dirty dishes. And unfortunately, he found out, and he was really, really mad at me. Until at holiday Christmas parties, some friends said, you know, my daughter would have come back to me for the money, and you, she got a job. So he wasn't that mad.
What's the website address for the Neurology Center?
www.neurologycenter.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Sally Seiler, who's the CEO of Neurology Center. Don't forget to visit our website, Executive Leaders Radio, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us for this segment is Ann McCabe-Triana, who's a partner with CAM Private Wealth Services. What is CAM Private Wealth Services, Ann?
CAM is a boutique financial planning and wealth management firm in Ruston. So the financial planning is basically taking a snapshot of where a person is financially and looking at where they want to be in the future, whether that's for retirement or college or any other financial goal, and building a roadmap in terms of how to get there.
What do you think makes you guys better than everybody else?
We have a unique structure in that we are fully independent, so we have no conflicts of interest. We legally work for our clients, which is a big deal, but we have a relationship and we use Wells Fargo Advisors as our broker-dealer, meaning we have access to the platform of one of the largest brokerage firms in the country. So we like to say we have the best of both worlds.
And what do you like most about what you do?
I love helping people. You know, Zig Ziglar, I think, said there's money's not the most important thing, but it's up there with oxygen. And so, you know, we help people with one of the most important things in their life.
How long have you been doing it?
I've been in the industry for 12 years and had my own firm with my business partner for four.
Give us a real quick example of how you could help somebody.
Sure. People come to us mostly for retirement planning. They're usually within about 5 years of retiring, and they're not exactly sure what they need to do between now and then to make it happen. So we lay out a plan for them. We help them really hone in on what their goals are and what they need to do between now and then. And most importantly, what is that paycheck going to look like for them in retirement?
Great. What's the website address?
Our website is www.CAMPrivateWealth.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Ann McCabe-Triana, who's a partner with CAM Private Wealth Services. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and that's your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, and today's show is brought to us by Bernhardt Wealth Management, helping to make work optional for you. For this segment, we have Andy Stern, who is the president of Andy Stern's Office Furniture, and he's joined by his father, Sam Stern. Andy, tell us a little bit about Andy Stern's Office Furniture.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, we have a long history of business in Washington since my father, who's here with us, started us in the late 40s. We are a full-service office furniture dealership. We have four showrooms in the Washington area, in Maryland, Virginia, and D.C., and we provide everything from interior design services to final delivery and installation.
And your father is here. This company has a long history. When was it first started?
It was first started actually before World War II. And then my dad, Sam, who can tell you more about this, went off to the war, left the business in a friend's hand. When he came back, there really was no business, so he restarted again in 1948, and that's pretty much when we say our founding was.
Yeah. So, Sam, why start a business?
Why start a business? I already was in the business and enjoyed it. I'd worked for others, and so I felt that was a good way for me to make a livelihood.
But what surprised you most when you started the business on your own? What was the biggest surprise looking back on it?
There weren't very many big surprises. It was just a question of basics. Find a client and go and get the merchandise, deliver it, and collect for it.
And over the years, how big did the business get, Andy?
We ended up with well over 200 employees, and we were the largest in Washington, D.C. in the office interiors business.
Looking back on it, what was the most fun for you, Sam?
Most fun for me was buying the furniture and learning all about the new things and being able to show them to people and have a large, beautiful display place for people to come and see it and feel it and touch it.
So as you grew the company, what did you find to be the most challenging part of running the business?
Most challenging part was going from basic used furnishings to selling some of the finest manufacturers in the world.
How did you keep up with all the changes?
It was a battle. You had to visit the shows, visit the showrooms, and be willing to be trained.
Uh-huh. Andy, when did you get into the business?
I joined the business back in 1977, actually. So I've been 36 years.
That's a long time. Why? Why get in the family business?
You know, my dad didn't talk about the business a lot when we were growing up. I knew the business was there. It provided a very nice livelihood for our family, but he didn't bring work home. But I graduated from college. I'd been working on Capitol Hill. It started to seem really interesting. It was more complex than I realized, and then he took me with him to a trade show one year in Chicago, and it just blew my mind.
So how did you start out in the business?
It was very interesting. He designed a management training program for me.
Just for you?
Just for me. First one that ever.
What was day one like?
Day one was show up, fill out the paperwork, and then drive down to the warehouse and start opening cartons of furniture and get them on the truck.
So was your son a good employee, Sam?
He was fantastic.
Hardworking guy?
Very hardworking guy and very creative. Well, and as a matter of fact, later on in the business, we had a strong union, and he decided, told us, my brother and I, that we weren't in the trucking business. We were in the furniture business, and he wanted to get rid of the trucks, which he did.
And that turned out to be a good decision?
It did. We actually went, and now thinking back on it, this is 25 years ago,
right.
We actually outsourced our delivery services, which is the way everyone does it now.
Yeah, but back then that was an early adopter kind of a thing, wasn't it?
Exactly. I didn't really know that it was outsourcing. All I knew was we hired a company that paid their we paid a percentage of the cost of goods, and they paid their guys on a commission for
everything.
Wasn't
that risky?
It was risky, but we had seen it done in a couple of other industries, not in the office furniture industry, but a couple of others, and it seemed to be successful.
So that allowed you, so I guess that you're kind of innovative. Would you characterize yourself that way?
Well, I would say that I'm carrying on the tradition of innovation that my dad started. He was, he can tell you about all the firsts in his company, but it's like the first dealership to hire an interior designer. He introduced Washington to something that's so mundane now you don't even think about it, but it's the lateral file, which is the wide, skinny file. There weren't those things back in those days. He hired the first minority salespeople in the city, just thing after thing, and so I've tried to carry on that tradition.
So, Sam, where did this penchant for innovation come from?
It was all very natural. It flowed. You read and you see and you listen, and you just do what flows.
So it never felt like risk to you?
No. As a matter of fact, my brother used to say often, are you sure that'll work? I would buy quite a number of pieces of furniture if we could get an exceptional buy, and we'd bring it in. He said, what are we going to do with this? I said, we'll sell it. And we did.
So I'll bet, I mean, you make it sound so easy. Tell us about one decision that went wrong.
The one decision that went wrong actually was we changed from one major manufacturer of metal office furnishings to another. And we changed because they romanced us for a period of 4 or 5 years and made all kinds of promises to us, which they did not fulfill. And as it turned out, they were trying to run our business and tell us how to run our business. And we finally, after a lot of back and forth fighting, we just finally told them if they didn't cease and desist, we were just going to throw the line out.
What did you learn from that?
I learned from that that I was a bit naive, and the name was impressive, and don't go by that anymore.
Right, right.
You have to find out, is it really right?
So many years later, something very disruptive entered your industry called big box stores. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was in the late 80s, and at first we didn't, because the Staples of the world and the Office Depots of the world were mostly office supplies, we didn't think it was going to affect the office furniture business, but it did, in that it put office supply dealerships under pressure to have more sales, which they did by selling more furniture. And so all of a sudden we had a lot more competition than we ever had before.
How'd you handle it?
Well, the whole business changed. It went from being sort of a mass market business. We used to do a lot of radio advertising and newspaper advertising to more of a personal sale business. And that's what we did. We hired and invested in salespeople and developing individual relationships and abandoned the other marketing strategy.
And you got out of the business for a while, right?
I did not, no.
You sold it?
We sold the company. We had a transition, actually, from my dad and uncle's ownership to mine. But I stayed on. We sold it to a big company, and then we bought it back, myself and my management team.
And what's it been like since then?
Well, I think the business has changed an awful lot as the country has, and as the business atmosphere in the country. There's not as much leeway anymore for mistakes. Margins are tighter, and I'm sure you hear this from lot of the people you interview. Sales are harder to find, and so you can't make mistakes anymore. It's you got to watch everything, every little expense, everyone you hire, everything you're thinking about doing. It's got to be tough, and for us, we're a business that you need to have businesses growing and expanding and making capital purchases. And in the last 5 years, of course, that's been difficult.
Yeah.
But we're here, and we're a business, and we're successful. So that's good.
What do you love most about your job?
I think there's great satisfaction in having someone come to us who's moving and has been handed floor plans by a landlord and said, I don't know what to do. And we end up 2-3 months later with a beautiful office, everyone working the way they should be, and the client really happy. That's very fulfilling.
Yeah. Sam, where are you from?
I'm originally from the state of Maine.
And what were you doing as a kid?
As a kid, I lived in a very interesting household, and I was pretty much, being the youngest, not neglected, but just not supervised as much.
You're 96 years old, so you've been around the block a few times. Tell us about your mom and dad.
Well, my mom and dad were from Europe, mother from Russia and father from Lithuania. And very interesting. My mother was a very artistic and very lovely woman, and very good with the children. My father was a kind of a tough old-timer, a European type, but very smart and very very attuned to better things for people. And he ultimately served, even with his very strong, heavy foreign accent, serving in the state of Maine legislature, sponsoring such things as 40-hour working week, abolishment of the sweatshops, child labor laws, and all of the liberal things that Mr. Roosevelt did when he became president.
So the Stern family has a long legacy of innovation.
Yes. And one thing about my grandfather, besides all that, he was an entrepreneur. He had several small businesses. And if we had more time, my dad could tell you about the fact that when my grandfather went off to the state legislature, he was the guy running the businesses, even when he was a kid. And that was hard because one of them was a window cleaning business, and you had to get up at 5 in the morning, right, and get the guys and the team going, and in the middle of the winter when it was 30 degrees below in Maine, right?
It was. It was difficult, but it was good training.
Washing windows in 30 degrees, that's got to be a...
You might be interesting another thing about the Stern Office Furniture Company. We really were four businesses. We had our retail stores, which were called the Office Furniture Mart Division. We had our unit that was called Stern Office Furniture, which did the interior design work. And then we had a wholesale thing. If you were an architect or a decorator and you needed some things, we would sell it to you from our inventory. And then if you were a purchaser and you needed to furnish more than you could possibly afford, then we would work out a leasing arrangement for you.
So, Sam, what are you most proud of across all the years?
Most proud of is my family.
And Andy, how about you?
Say that again.
He asked me the same question, and yeah. I would have to say the same thing.
What do you appreciate most about your dad?
My dad is an incredible role model, and, a giant of a man, and not just a great businessman, but also a great human. And he's just taught me so much about how to live a good life and how to be part of your community, and how family always comes first before anything else.
Great. What's the website address?
Our website address is www.andysterns.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Andy Stern and his dad, Sam Stern. Andy's the president of Andy Stern's Office Furniture. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
Joining us for this Business Spotlight is Lee Self, president and owner of Renaissance Executive Forums. Lee, what is Renaissance Executive Forums?
Renaissance Executive Forums is a group of business owners and CEOs who come together and learn from each other, from each other's real-life experiences in business.
And what do clients appreciate most about Renaissance Executive Forums?
The ability to come together in a real high-trust environment and have their thinking challenged by others who have been where they are.
Why is trust so important?
Because these folks, you know, they run businesses, they have a lot of employees who depend on them, and they're expected to have all the answers, and yet they don't. So they need a place where they can go and kind of let their hair down and talk about the things they're uncertain of.
What does your perfect client look like?
Perfect client would be an individual who's running a very successful, stable business, maybe has 100 employees, and is restless with where they are, and looking to move maybe to the next level growing, or looking to move in a different direction, and knowing that they don't have all the answers.
What do you enjoy most about your work?
What I enjoy most about my work is sitting back and watching them help each other in ways I could never imagine, because they get each other.
Interesting. They get each other.
Yeah.
And you don't have to do the work for them.
No, I just get to. The most important thing I do is bring great members into the forum.
What's the website?
www.executiveforums.com.
Thank you for listening to this Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. Today's show is sponsored by Bernhardt Wealth Management, helping to make work optional for you. And for this segment, we have Rob Cortell, who's the chairman and CEO of a company called Intellix. What is Intellix?
Well, at a high level, we're a software solutions company, but at a high level, what we do is applied operational decision analytics, which means basically we use technologies to automate decision processes in usually regulatory agencies. Sometimes I tell people we automate human decision making. That's a my guys tell me that's not exactly true, but
it's awfully intriguing.
Yeah.
So give us an example, a real life example of how you do that.
Well, for example, we work with agencies like the FDA and Consumer Product Safety, TSA, and others. At FDA, we have a system called Predict, which is used to help them decide on some of the 30 million cargoes that come in imports that they regulate every year. So, you know, typically and historically, a screener would sit in front of a green screen and he'd have 8 seconds to decide what to do with a cargo. Let it in, don't let it in, send it for inspection. And our system takes all of the knowledge of the FDA and the rules and the data analysis and it converts it into essentially a score. And about 80% of all those cargoes now it says, this is what you should do. And then the other 20%, the human comes in and they really have to make the final decision.
So what is the benefit of that? It saves on labor or increases efficiencies what?
Well, we think one of the biggest problems today in government, it doesn't matter where your politics are, you know, whether right or left or whatever, the reality is governments at all levels have more and more and more to do, more regs, more this and that. And again, the reality is the resources that they have to do that, they're going to shrink. So, you know, we go to work every day knowing that what we're doing is helping these guys and women in these agencies do their job better. It helps them make a better decision. It's faster. It's more consistent. And, you know, at the end of every decision is typically a person, you know, whether you're shipping a product or whether you're going to be using some medicine that comes in through imports. So we're very mindful of that. And it doesn't replace people. It gives people the ability to extend what they do by many times.
Right. How did you get the idea for the business?
Well, we really we didn't start out here. You know, a lot of businesses zig and zag.
Yeah.
And we about a little over a decade ago, I had been federal maritime commissioner under the first Bush, and I'd run for U.S. Senate in Florida, and I'd done shipbuilding, a startup, and had left that. And one day, I was sitting with a friend of mine out here, who's a serial entrepreneur, Bruce Finland, and I was saying, well, you know, the internet, it's got rail.com and trucks.com and this and that.com, and someone should do something in shipping. And he says, well, someone will. Why don't you? I'll raise you the money. So he and I and the current president of the company, Dhiren Patel, we started the company in my library, and it went through several, you know, we went through phases, of course, and the big change was really 9/11. Yeah. So when that happened, we had really taken control of the company. You know, the VCs had some level of control. And I woke up one morning about 3 weeks afterwards and said, bleep, you could put a nuclear bomb in a container. And got with my staff and friends at the Army Science Board and other places, and we really figured out a paradigm to use data, not physical inspection of the 40 million containers, and that became what the country does, and we got our first contract out of that.
Is this your first business that you've run?
I had consulting business for a number of years. I was a partner in a small firm in D.C., and then went on my own.
This is your first kind of enterprise?
This first real enterprise like this, although I ran a startup, and really my career began with startups in federal agencies. You know, I went to Rice and went home after I graduated for a week and drove to Washington without a job. And I knew that the deputy administrator was a Rice graduate and went in his office and more or less came out with a job. And EPA was really only a couple years old then, and I was there for maybe six months, and then the oil embargo happened. And that's, you know, for a lot of old folks, we remember that. Long lines, and I had a friend at the White House, and he called me over, and I ended up working with the new Federal Energy Office for about a year, and then Nixon resigned, and President Ford became the president, and then he pardoned the Vietnam-era draft resistors and started a new agency, the Presidential Clemency Board,
and you were part of that.
So, you know, I really was in startups from the very beginning, but they were government startups.
Yeah.
And that was something that really drove me to go to business school eventually and all that, because, we think of all these smart people out here in startups and enterprises, but boy, in those days, there were a lot of smart people in the government. There still are. But OMB in those days had 200 people in management, unlike the 20 or so they had today. So these were people who knew regression analysis, and they were smart, and they got a Harvard and this and blah, blah, blah. And it was really inspirational. But those were startups, too.
Yeah.
Those, you know.
Have you always been kind of creating things or been a part of the front end of something?
Most of my friends would say I'm sort of an iconoclast or a, you know, contrarian, and I don't like doing what other people do. So I really have not worked for anyone else since I was in my late 20s, uh-huh. And I'm now 63. So I definitely like being on my own. I was yeah. When I was a kid, I always wanted to be the general or the president.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Orlando. My parents had moved down from Baltimore. My father was in the space program. My mother was from Virginia. I think I told someone the story that, you know, it was like I'm an eighth or ninth generation Virginian. And when she was pregnant, they were living out in Texas. He was training Korean pilots for the war. And she flew all the way back to Virginia to make sure I wasn't the first child born outside the state. And but I did grow up in Florida and wanted to be an astronaut. First guy on Mars, not the moon, and then went to Rice because I thought I'd learn to fly, and they had a space program. Of course, in those days, we didn't know that was a graduate program. You know, we didn't have the internet to tell us what they really did.
Yeah.
And I found out I didn't like to fly, and I didn't want to take my life in my own hands, and I don't scuba dive either, even though my whole family scuba dives. So,
what do you remember most about growing up in Orlando? I mean, that was the early days of the space program, wasn't it?
Right, it was, and you know. When we moved there, there were only about 30,000 people, and then Martin Marietta brought all of us down, and they doubled the population, and by the time I left in high school, Disney came in the following year, and so boomed up to 4 million. But I do vividly remember, as a kid, standing there, my father would call over at 4:30 and say, I can't tell you why, but look east, because all the space program in those days were secret, you know, because they were afraid they'd blow up. Well, every so often they did, and you see this contrail going up, and then it kind of turn over, and boom. So that was, you know, and we also did a lot of camping. I was Boy Scout and Eagle Scout, yeah. And those days you were hacking your way through the woods.
What was the conversation at dinner time like?
Well, did you do your homework? actually, it was fun. My father was he was an engineer. My mother was a chemist. She was the first one of the first women to go to VPI, now Virginia Tech.
Right, right.
And so, you know, she was a great voracious reader, and I was a great reader. But my father would pick up animals on the trip. He'd drive 50 miles to the Cape every day and back. And sometimes he'd bring baby snakes, and some days he'd bring baby armadillos. And I remember these animals coming and dying, basically. So it was, you know, a normal family conversation.
Other role models along the way, significant mentors, important influences?
Boy, so many people. You know, nobody travels, you know, through life alone, really. I mean, all these things, all people have a lot of influence. You know, my wife is a huge influence, been married 32 years, and... my best friend. I chased her for 7 years, and she's a very successful businesswoman who now heads an organization called Fight for Children, founded by Joe Robert, who is a very successful business guy.
Real estate guy.
That does education reform.
Right.
They just had their big night. They just raised $4 million, the biggest fundraiser in a long time. And then professionally, it was a guy named Bill Strauss, who later worked for Percy. And I met him at the Presidential Clemency Board. He'd gone to Harvard, undergrad, Harvard Law School, went to... first class of the Kennedy School, and you know, I was just so impressed by what he knew in terms of management analysis and how he approached problems. And I had been accepted. I thought about going to law school and accepted admission to Yale to the management school, the first class. And he said, "Do that." He was a first class at Kennedy School, and said, "There's nothing like being in the first class to help build an institution." And that's been was so true. And he went on to form the Capital Steps, and unfortunately died.
Right.
You know, 5 years ago.
Where do you want the company to be in 5 years?
You know, everybody goes to work every day. They don't think about doing decision analytics or risk and analytics or anything like that. What they think about is the fact that we really are working with people in these agencies who are trying to do a good job. And,
right.
And what we're trying to do is help them do a better job every day. And, you know, what I'd like to see is that we're doing more and more of that. You know, I look around the government, you know, someone once said, is there anything groundbreaking here? And is this a business thing or a government thing? I think the government is ripe for this kind of analysis. I look at the VA and the 2 million applications, and they're now fewer than that, but you know, half of them have to go back through again because they don't like the decision, or it's not made well or something, or there's an error. State Department visas, you look across the government with all these regulatory agencies, and they're going to have to automate these processes. And when they do, it's going to make a big difference in people's lives at the other end of this pipeline.
And why is that so important to you?
You know, I just think from experience, I've been in and out of government off and on, and I've run, as I said, a couple times, and there's nothing like running for public office, even if you lose, because people, from the minute you go out there, they think of you as being in that role, and they want you to help them. They want you to represent them, but they also want you to help them on whatever it is. And I don't know, it's just gratifying. And it's the same thing as company.
What's your proudest moment up till now?
I don't know if there is anyone. You know, I feel lucky. You know, and my wife, we've built three great houses. We build good houses that sell for a lot of money. They really are great houses. We've traveled everywhere. My kids are turning out fine. I'm proud of the fact that the business does something important.
Yeah.
We're not just crunchers. We're not just butts in seats. So there's a lot.
Yeah. What's the website address?
www.ntelx.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Rob Cortell, who's the chairman and CEO of Intellex. We've had a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Norma Scherrera, who is a partner with Luce Gorman, Sally Seiler, who is the CEO of Neurology Center, Andy Stern, along with his father, Sam Stern, Andy's the president of Andy Stern's Office Furniture, and finally, once again, Rob Cortell, the chairman and CEO of Intellex. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
Did you know that more than 80,000 people in our area have lupus? Join the Lupus Foundation of America, D.C., Maryland, Virginia chapter on Saturday, December 7th for the 5th annual Purple Passion Gala to end lupus. Take part in an exciting live and silent auction at the Park Hyatt Washington to support free services for people with lupus, a life-threatening disease with no known cure. For tickets, call 1-888-787-5380 or visit lupusdmv.org. and help us solve the cruel mystery.
In the wake of a disaster, what one thing can you send that will help people the most? A blanket, a tent, a sandbag, a doctor. Actually, if you send a monetary donation, you send all these things. Even a small donation can make a big impact and can quickly become exactly what people affected by disaster need most.
Want to help those affected by Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines? To donate, visit philippinesrelief.adcouncil.org. That's philippinesrelief.adcouncil.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Sometimes I know what I want to say, but just can't find the words.
Last week I shouted at my grandson, and I'm not sure why.
I saw my daughter, but couldn't remember her name.
The sooner you recognize the warning signs of Alzheimer's disease, the sooner you can do something about it. To learn more, go to alz.org/10signs. That's alz.org/10signs. A message from the Alzheimer's Association.
When I served in Iraq and Afghanistan, my buddies and I would do anything for each other. That's important whether you're in a firefight or fighting to regain your life. When I came home injured, there are people I can count on, like DAV.
DAV, Disabled American Veterans, stands behind America's veterans to make their transition back home easier with free services and help getting the benefits they've earned. Help us fulfill the promise to our men and women who served. Go to DAV.org to learn more.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio.